2 a.m. by SPQR, a Mel Langdon fic, originally posted March 22nd, 2025. Summary. I don't understand why you're letting that asshole crash at your place, Santos says, flopping back on the couch in the break room. Seriously, Mel, there's a reason his wife kicked him out. Author's note. Not sure about these characterizations, but in the brave words of Dr. Ellis, the only way out is through. I don't understand why you're letting that asshole crash at your place, Santos says, flopping back on the couch in the break room. Seriously, Mel, there's a reason his wife kicked him out. Ex-wife, Mel corrects, though she's not sure why the distinction is important to her. And she's not even sure it's true, since she's a little fuzzy as far as where in the divorce proceedings Langdon and Abby actually are. He's been looking for his own place, scrolling Zillow mindlessly on her couch while she and Becca watch Survivor, but she gets the sense he's not looking that hard, like maybe he's expecting Abby to take him back. Whatever, Santos says, with an arm over her eyes. He's got big, needy man-baby energy written all over him. I bet he liked calling Abby mommy in bed. Mel says, uncomfortable. All I'm saying is, don't let him trap you into taking care of him, doing his laundry and cooking him dinner and shit. I won't, Mel says. I mean, he's not trying to. Even though she did do Langdon's laundry this afternoon, when they woke up for their shift. But he cooked breakfast for the two of them, pancakes with blueberries, which was also dinner for her sister before Becca's overnight caretaker showed up, pausing in the door as they went past her into the hall to give her customary judgmental look to the mess of Langdon's blankets on the couch. So Mel figures, on balance, it's not a red flag. Look, I know men like him, Santos says. Like Mel hasn't said anything. I dated a man like him in undergrad. Life is so hard and I'm so special and it's totally okay if I develop a drug habit and make my girlfriend give me Narcan in the living room. She's pre-med. She won't mind. Mel says again. There's a lot to unpack there psychologically, but she's had a kind of a long night and she thinks it's probably better left to Kiara or a mental health professional. I know you don't trust him, but he really is clean. Santos scowls under her arm. What, are you checking his pee? Mel blinks. No, I get it, Santos says, sitting up. She's being weirdly intense about this whole thing, and Mel doesn't really understand why she's so invested. The whole mentor-mentee thing. You think because he's nice to you and tells you you're good at your job and takes care of you at work that he actually cares about you, that you're friends. We are friends, Mel doesn't say, because it's been a year and she's still not entirely sure it's true. Before Langdon showed up at her doorstep with a suitcase and a hangdog expression, they'd spent maybe 3 hours together outside of work, and none of those alone, because alone felt dangerous for some reason. She doesn't want to touch the actually cares about you with a 10-foot pole. Santos is watching her face carefully. Maybe even more than friends, she prods. Mel feels her cheeks turn hot, but she doesn't meet Santos's eyes. No, she says, voice a little choked, mortified. He wouldn't. I'm on your side here, Dr. King, Santos says, squeezing her hand. And it takes Mel a second to realize that she's not being teased maliciously, that Santos isn't going to give her shit about what she thinks Mel feels about Langdon, at least not outside of this room. I'm as surprised as you are, but we're actually, like, friends. Mel makes herself look up. What, just because you're mean to me and tell me I'm bad at my job? Santos narrows her eyes, drops Mel's hand. I hate how you say being funny for strategic moments. It feels very targeted. I feel targeted. You are targeted, Mel tells her. Santos gives her a look like she almost wants to laugh. And then the door bangs open and Dr. Garcia sticks her head in, evidently storming down to the ER from surgery and barks, What the fuck are you two doing in here? Get up, there's a mass casualty event coming in. Some dumbass kids flipped over a party bus. And their pagers go off and they're scrambling up to follow her. For what she likes to think are obvious, understandable reasons, Mel hates the night shift. She hates the transition period when they switch over, when for a week, never less than a week, she feels like a zombie. Never awake when she should be awake, and never asleep when she should be asleep. Sleepy time tea and melatonin and all the coffee in the world not enough to force her body to shift its rhythms. She hates when the ER, which is chaotic on a normal day during the daytime, gets flooded with patients who are drunk and high, along with little kids in matching pajamas and scared parents in robes and slippers, rocking babies who won't stop crying. She hates that she can't step outside and look at the sun, like nothing exists outside the hospital at all. She hates that she barely gets to see Becca because she spends her days sleeping while her sister's at care, and she hates getting off shift while the rest of the world is getting up and going to work. But it's only fair. Everyone has to do their time on the night shift. And she minds it a lot less this time, since Dr. Langdon got assigned with her. Last time it was just her, Whitaker, and Santos, along with Dr. Collins. Mel spent a miserable month passing Langdon in the locker room on her way in and out of work, both of them too tired and busy to say anything but hello, feeling strangely lost all shift, even though Dr. Collins was a more than competent teacher. This time, she has Langdon with her. Not just on night shift, but sleeping on her couch and driving to work with her and eating pretty much every meal with her and Becca when he doesn't take his kids for the weekend. Abby stays with a friend and he takes the house for that. But Mel feels weirdly happy and steady and calm most of the time. It's not a feeling she's used to. Another feeling she's not used to. She's pretty sure her patient is flirting with her. "You're really good with your hands, Doc," he says, smiling loopily while she sews up a superficial gash on his head. Thank you, Mel says, wishing she could back away from him, but that would make sewing the head wound sort of difficult. He's one of the frat boys from the party bus that flipped over. Miraculously, no one is too terribly injured, though they're all going to have pretty bad hangovers, and the guy in Trauma 1 with a broken femur is screaming a lot. "He's a crybaby," Mel's patient tells her with a drunk laugh. "Pledges are all fucking crybabies." "Broken femurs are very painful," Mel tells him. He's looking at her cross-eyed. "You've got a sort of, like, a hot kindergarten teacher thing going, you know that? Like a strict, hot kindergarten teacher." "I think I should check for a concussion again," Mel decides. "You might have an intracranial bleed." Before she can move away to grab a pen light, she feels a hand land on her backside and squeaks, "Oop!" At the same time that the curtain rattles back and Dr. Langdon says, "Oh, fuck no! Get your fucking hands off my resident, you asshole! Mel, I'll finish this." And Mel is snatching her bloody latex hands back and squirreling out of the bay before she can see anything more than the blankly furious look on Langdon's face. She feels a little shaky while she strips her gloves off and trashes them. But then McKay needs help with a hip reduction, and a paramedic rushes in with the severed finger they were looking for a few minutes ago. And by the time she's ready to reattach that, her hands are steady again. The patient with the broken femur stops screaming just in time for Santos to get in a fist fight with one of the frat boys, which, by the time it's over, has dragged in Mateo and two more pledges and all the security guards. Half the bus patients end up cuffed to their beds, and one has a new broken nose, courtesy of Santos's fist, that Dr. Robbie wisely doesn't let Santos set. Once Mel's done with the severed finger, she stands at the nurse's station and watches the whole scene with a sort of fascinated horror, as Perla and Princess mutter to each other. She can't tell what they're saying, despite the few words of Tagalog that Santos has taught her. But she can tell by now how they keep snickering that they're having a great time. She feels a body at her side and knows it's Langdon by the way her own shoulders relax even before he calls out to a passing security guard, "Hey, you missed one," and nods to the guy with the head wound. Mel looks at him in confusion. He wasn't in the fight. Langdon glances at her and then away, too fast to read the expression on his face. "Doesn't matter. He assaulted one of my doctors." Mel starts to say, "He didn't," then stops to think about whether she would defend him the same way if it had been Santos he grabbed, or Javadi. And she doesn't finish. "I think it's because he's concussed," she says instead. "Men don't really..." She stops, flushing and swallows. Langdon's staring at her, she can tell, but she doesn't look at him. Behind them, Perla and Princess have gone silent in that way that means they're watching raptly. "Thanks for, Mel says, wishing the floor would open up and swallow her, finishing that suture. "No problem," Langdon says. His voice sounds a little weird, like maybe he's coming down with something. But by the time Mel works through her misplaced embarrassment and looks over at him, he's already looking away, because paramedics are rushing in an unresponsive 4-year-old through the door, with Jesse up on the gurney doing CPR, and it's time to go to work. Her name is Lily, the paramedic reports as they complete the handover in Trauma 2. She had a marble down her throat when we got there, not sure how long she was without air. Compressions and oxygen all the way here, but we haven't had any luck getting a pulse. Lily, says another girl miserably from the door, 12 or 13, in her socks, with tears on her face. Mel falters where she's getting into gloves and a gown, and the paramedic tells her, her sister, Phoebe, she was the one who called us. No parents? Mel asks, because it is the middle of the night. The paramedic just shakes her head. Okay, Mel says. She glances back at Lily. Langdon and McKay are on it, with Jafadi assisting. Phoebe, why don't we wait outside while they try and help your sister? Phoebe doesn't respond. She's in shock, obviously, but Mel herds her out as gently as she can and then snags Princess on the way past. Can you see if you can find, the social worker for me? It's Adam tonight. Princess tells her. I'll go find him. Thanks, Mel says. I'll wait with Phoebe in the family room. Princess gives Phoebe a sympathetic look and goes to find Adam. Mel takes Phoebe into the family room, and the second they're inside with the door closed, Phoebe sits down and puts her face in her hands and just starts sobbing. And Mel feels abruptly so out of her depth that she shifts her feet in a nervous little motion before she sits down and puts a hand on Phoebe's shoulder. Hey, she says. I know this is hard. It's really hard. But you did the right thing calling 911. And now we're doing everything we can to help your sister. Phoebe scrubs at her face angrily. I keep telling her that marbles aren't candy, but she won't listen to me. She never listens to me. Mel feels a knot of something in her chest. Phoebe, do you have your phone? Or do you maybe know your parents' phone numbers? We should call them. Phoebe sniffles and takes her phone out of her pocket, hands it to Mel without looking. I called my mom a bunch already. You can try if you want, but she won't pick up. The only way she's showing up at this hospital is if she ODs and comes in an ambulance. A year in the ER, and Mel's still figuring out how to wisely and responsibly advise her patients on the issues she can't even solve for herself. This one's too close to home. She just sits there uselessly with Phoebe's phone in her hand for a few minutes until Adam shows up. And then she takes herself back to Trauma 2 to check on Lily. They've got her back, strong pulse, and good bilateral breath sounds, though they do think she aspirated a marble before EMS arrived. Mel lingers around the door while Jafadi and McKay wheel in an x-ray to look for it. Really, she should see who she can bring back from chairs. They don't need her here. But all she can think about is the time when she was 10 and her mom disappeared for a month and Becca broke her arm. Having to find the language to explain to the nurses and doctors in the ER why the sister who was 4 years younger was filling out all the forms and doing all the explaining. Why Becca kept shoving anyone who tried to touch her away. Why their mom wasn't there and wasn't answering her phone. They'd had to sedate Becca eventually because they couldn't put her in restraints with the broken wrist, and Mel had just sat at her bedside and stared at her. So unnaturally still, with a feeling in her chest like something frozen and empty and dark. By the time she turned 11, Mel had a handle on the Byzantine ins and outs of the American health insurance system, but she never really got the hang of lying to social services. And there's a lot of lying to social services. She wonders if Phoebe is going to try to lie to social services tonight, and if she does, whether Mel is going to let her. Hey, says Langdon beside her. You okay? Mel blinks at him. For a second, she can't remember where she is, what's exactly going on, but she knows those eyes. Sad and smart and icy blue, like a husky. Langdon. Langdon, who is always there to prop her up when she feels unsteady, who's staying on her couch, who's going to drive her home. Mel, he prods, concerned. Last night, their night, so daytime, really, with all the blackout curtains drawn, Becca at care, the apartment quiet and pitch dark. Mel couldn't sleep, so she left her bedroom for a glass of water, and when she passed the couch, Langdon lifted his head, groggy, hair a mess, and squinted at her over the back. Mel? He'd asked, sticky, and she could hear somehow how offensive his morning breath would be. His body was just a dark lump beneath the blankets, but she knew that under there he was like a pile of sticks, skinny, long, pale limbs, because she'd seen him first thing in the morning shuffling around zombie-like, making coffee in boxer shorts and a t-shirt. She'd watched his arms enough in the ER. Working and suddenly thinking about his body made her aware of her own, her bare feet under her sweatpants and her hair down, still damp from the shower, and she'd told him, nothing, just getting a glass of water. And he'd put his head back down and gone to sleep, snoring softly. and she'd gotten her water and gone back down the hall to her bedroom. But she'd lingered for a moment in the doorway, looking out at the couch, thinking about, maybe, what it would be like to go out there and sit next to him, too close and too warm, and lean against him and talk with him softly, to hear him talk to her. Now, in Trauma 2, Langdon glances back at McKay and Javadi, still looking for the aspirated marble, then takes her elbow and gently steers her out into the hallway. "Mel, come on," he says, when they're alone in front of an empty bay. "It freaks me out when you do this." "Do what?" Mel asks. Langdon relaxes a little, like he was waiting to hear her talk, but he doesn't let go of her elbow. "You just, like, go blank all of a sudden. That's how I know something's really wrong, when you're still." Mel shakes her head a little. "I'm fine." Langdon ignores her. "Is it the sisters thing?" "No, it's just..." Mel starts, then realizes there's no reason to lie to him and starts over. "Yes, it's the sisters thing, and also..." "GSW to the chest," a paramedic yells, crashing a gurney through the ambulance bay doors. Langdon still doesn't move, his hand on Mel's elbow, until over at the gurney, Dr. Mohan yells, "Dr. King, Dr. Langdon, I could use some help over here. He's tachycardic, the abdomen's rigid, and there's no exit wound. I think the bullet ricocheted around in there, massive internal hemorrhage. Summon Page surgery now!" And it's Mel who breaks away, rushing to the bedside of their newest patient, with Langdon right behind her. They lose the GSW patient before surgery even shows up, which is just as hard as it always is, even though the only people here for him are the police. After the body's wheeled out, Mel checks on Dickhead McGrabby Hands, as Santos has taken to calling him, who's stable and surprisingly not concussed, but really starting to feel his hangover. Mel only has a minute to be thankful that Langdon's too busy with Lily's laparoscopic marble removal to check the sutures himself, since he'd probably tell the guy that the splitting headache and nausea served him right, before Santos invites herself into the bay and does Langdon's work for him. "Serves you fucking right, ass face," she says by way of introduction. "Honestly, grooming your doctor." "Hey," says Dickhead McGrabby Hands ass face, aka, according to his chart, Tom, holding his hands up in a gesture of abject, sparkling innocence. "It's not my fault the doctors here are snacks." Mel blinks at him, startles, and finds him leering at her with the look she normally observes when Dr. Santos is appreciating Dr. Garcia's rear end. "Thank you," she says. "Don't thank him," Santos says, disgusting, shouldering Mel out of the way to replace the dressing herself. She jostles their patient so he turns a little green, then says, "Oops, sorry. If you puke on me, I'll send Dr. Langdon back in. Don't think I won't." "Fuck no," Tom says. "That guy was fucking scary." Santos flicks his forehead. "Excuse me, I'm not fucking scary. He threatened to staple my head." "Oh, Dr. Langdon wouldn't do that," Mel says. "He's a very good doctor. I'm sure he was just offering surgical staples as an alternative to sutures. Some people with an aversion to needles prefer them." Tom and Santos give her twin looks of disbelief. "What?" Mel says. "Are you kidding?" Santos asks. "Is she kidding?" Tom asks Santos. "Hey," Santos flicks him in the head again. "Shut up." I'm not kidding," Mel says, confused. When Santos finishes up with Tom, Dana takes pity on Mel and sends her to look at a baby in the peds room. A newborn little girl who has nothing wrong with her except that her parents are first-timers and hypochondriacs. She's fussy, spitting up a little, but she's not sick. Mel just gets to spend 15 minutes taking her vitals and holding her tiny baby feet and assuring her very relieved and grateful parents that there is nothing at all to worry about. She discharges them and sends them home, and as she comes out of the peds room, she spots Dr. Langdon across the ER, shooting the shit with Dr. Garcia over a broken femur patient. He's got that fond, playful, sour look on his face that he gets when Garcia's insulting him, especially creatively. And Mel smiles a little watching him before she can help herself. She starts to head over to see if they need any help, but before she can get there, Adam the social worker intercepts her. "Dr. King, can I get a minute?" Mel sees the look on his face and fails to control her sinking stomach. "Yeah, of course. Is this about Phoebe and Lily?" "It is." Adam draws her into a side corridor, neatly stepping out of the way of a gurney as it trundles past with one of the party bus patients handcuffed and bound for radiology. "I haven't been able to get a hold of any guardian," Adam says, "but Phoebe has told me some about their situation. Their mother's never home. Phoebe says she's been in and out of rehab before, state mandated. Usually they stay with their grandmother, but she recently passed. Phoebe's become Lily's primary caregiver." Mel nods and hopes she's doing a better job than she feels like she's doing of keeping her inward spiral off her face. Are you going to bring in CPS? Adam looks exhausted, which in Mel's experience is how social workers normally look. Kiara is the uncanny exception. I have to. It's a negligent situation, clear as day. I know foster care is nobody's ideal situation, but from what Phoebe tells me, they have no other family, and I can't have a 13-year-old taking care of a 4-year-old. No, of course not, Mel says, though she'd been her sister's caretaker pretty much from the age of 12 onward. In hindsight, she knows she definitely should have asked for help, even if it led to her and Becca being split up. It's sort of a miracle nothing went permanently, mortally wrong. Do you need me to sit with Phoebe while you do that? Perla's in with her now, Adam says. I'd prefer to hold off calling CPS until Lily's stable. Phoebe's gone through a lot tonight already. I'd like her to have some relief before I ambush her with the next problem. Dr. McKay tells me she'll be all right, but would you keep an eye on things? Notify me when she's out of the woods. Of course, Mel says again, and then Adam smiles gratefully and leaves, and she's alone in the hall. She stands there for a minute, staring at nothing and silently feeling herself come unraveled. Then she puts her back to the wall and slides down to sit on the floor and draws her knees up to her chest so no one will see her feet sticking out past the ultrasound cart that someone's parked in here. There's no kind car crash victim with a dog in the ER tonight, so she doesn't have an animal friend to keep her company. But she picks all the nail polish off her nails and then gets up to scrub the little green flecks off her hands in the bathroom. And in the absence of Langdon available to sit companionably at her shoulder, it works well enough. For a little while it's quiet, though Mel's not green enough to say it out loud. She gives fluids and Tylenol to a kid with a bad stomach bug, x-rays and splints to a sprained ankle that's been sitting in chairs since the day shift clocked out, cleans a stubbed toe with a missing toenail, and has time to eat most of a snack before Adam finds her again. Dr. King, he says, catching her with a mouthful of mint chocolate Clif Bar. Adam. Mel covers her mouth while she chews and swallows as fast as she can, mindful of not choking because it would be pretty embarrassing for someone to have to give her the Heimlich in the middle of the ER. I don't have any updates on Lily. They had to send her up to surgery to get the marble out. It's not about Lily, Adam says. Perla appears at Mel's shoulder, listening, and he gives her a quick acknowledging look. I tried their mother again, and the paramedics picked up. The paramedics? Mel echoes. Nanku, says Perla, disbelieving. Overdose, Adam tells them. They're 5 minutes out. Or they were 4 minutes ago. Okay, Mel says, trashing her Clif Bar and heading towards the ambulance bay. You've got Phoebe. I've got her, Adam assures her, already on his way to the family room. Mel grabs gloves from the box just outside the automatic doors, and as they swish open, she looks to see Langdon with Dr. Robbie consulting over a patient's chart. And she knows she shouldn't interrupt. She knows that she and Perla, who's fallen in grimly next to her, can handle an overdose on their own. And she knows that whatever Langdon and Dr. Robbie are doing is definitely just as important. But she feels like she's going to fly out of her skin. She feels like her sneakers are barely touching the floor, and stupidly she thinks if he doesn't look up at her right now, she might cease to exist. Just fizzle away into nothing. And that's no way to meet an incoming patient. So she calls out, Dr. Langdon, and tries not to think too hard about the relief she feels when his head snaps up immediately. What have we got? He asks, joining them on their way out the doors. OD, Mel says as they head out into the night, biting cold, pitch dark beyond the lights of the bay. But Mel can already hear the sirens approaching, so they won't be out here for long. It's Lily and Phoebe's mother, the girl who came in with a marble, and her sister. Langdon mutters under his breath, shit. Then he looks at her. Mel feels sort of like a balloon that was about to drift away, except someone snagged her string at the last second and held her down. She can see his breath in front of his face and thinks for a second about how warm his body must be, then turns away from him and shivers. Scrubs are pretty versatile, but one thing they aren't is designed for winters in Pittsburgh. She crosses her arm and Langdon says, hey, are you... And she can tell that he's going to ask, okay, like he did earlier. Only he must realize that he's going to get the exact same non-answer, because he huffs like he's giving up and just puts an arm around her instead, squeezes, rubbing her shoulder like he's trying to keep her warm. Mel goes stiff as a board, and he stops. Sorry, he mutters. Hey, Perla says irritably next to them. I'm cold too, Dr. Langdon. Langdon laughs ruefully and shakes his head. And then the ambulance is there, lights and sirens roaring into the bay, and Mel doesn't have time to regret that the one time Langdon's ever touched her on purpose, she went right ahead and drove him off. It wasn't conscious. It wasn't that she didn't want him to touch her. It was just not something she's used to. But what's important right now is Lily and Phoebe's mom, who's barely conscious on a gurney as the paramedics get her out and down with her head lolling around bonelessly. One of them rapid fire through the handover. Female, mid-40s, no ID on her, but we talked to your social worker over the phone, and I think he knows who she is. I've got no idea what she took, but we couldn't find any intravenous marks. She responds to pain, but couldn't tell me her name in the ambulance. Mel jogs alongside the gurney while Langdon peels back the woman's eyelids and checks her pupil response, and Perla takes over the IV. What has she had? She asks the paramedic. Naloxone, the paramedic says. Pupils are fucking pinpricks, Langdon mutters. Heart rate was 45 on the bus, blood pressure 80-60. They get her into trauma one and park the gurney. On three, Langdon says, and Mel's so grateful he's taken over running the case she could cry. One, two, and they transfer the patient over onto the bed, Jesse shoving in at Perla's shoulder to help. He turns the patient's face towards him and goes in with the pen light again. Ma'am, can you hear me? My name is Dr. Langdon, and this is Dr. King. You're at Pittsburgh Trauma Medical Center. Can you tell me your name? The woman doesn't even try to make a sound, shying away from his hands and the light. Mel glances at her vitals. I don't think she's responding to the naloxone. Langdon looks at the monitor, too. Heart rate's dropping. It gets any lower, she's going to arrest. Shit. It could be benzos, Mel says. Her respiration's low. And somehow she doesn't remember until she sees Langdon's shoulders go tense under his scrubs that this could have been him half a year ago. That if she knows him at all, it still keeps him up at nights thinking about how he could have gone out like this, OD'd on benzos in his own ER, with two kids and a wife at home. Ex-wife, maybe. She does the kindest thing she can and doesn't say anything else. She just follows his instructions and tries to keep her own hands from shaking, determinedly not thinking about the two little girls waiting for this woman to get better, and not thinking even harder about how Langdon is probably thinking about them too now. Until finally, Dr. Robbie shows up and it doesn't feel like she has to be the most responsible doctor in the room anymore. Okay, someone says after a long time. Dr. Robbie, Mel thinks. Okay, she's coming around. And then the woman rolls over and pukes all over Mel's scrubs, and Mel is too overwhelmed with the relief to even be disgusted. The scrub machine isn't just out of her size, it's completely broken. Whitaker informs her miserably, unhelpfully, that they're not coming to fix it until the morning, and Mel is contemplating the dismal prospect of doing the rest of her shift in the fluffy pink sweater she wore to work, when Langdon calls down the hall. Mel, there's an extra set of scrubs in my locker. You know the combo, right? And Mel does, so she nods and waves awkwardly and thanks. The combination is Langdon's oldest son's birthday, 4/14/22. He's got his kids' drawings taped up inside the door. A lot of very abstract crayon squiggles that a very neat hand that must be either Abby's or a teacher's identifies as me and Daddy. Mel smiles a little, feeling like she always does when she brushes up tangentially against Langdon's kids, fond and uncomfortable and oddly hurt, even though she has no reason to be. Then finds the scrubs folded up on the top shelf, black and too big for her, and heads to the bathroom to change. It's a real high-wire act, getting out of the puke-covered shirt without getting any on her. But Mel has had a lot of practice, and she manages it. She tugs Langdon's scrub shirt over her head and then, in the privacy of the closed stall, holds it over her face for a second and leans her head against the stall door and breathes in the scent of him and just lets herself be very, very grateful that Santos and Dr. Robbie caught him, that he got help, got clean, went to rehab, that she never had to deal with him gray and unresponsive on her table, stripped naked and hooked up to machines and just small. She has a hard enough time thinking about how vulnerable he looks when he's sleeping on her couch, thinking about how she's not the only person to ever see him like that. She can't imagine how much worse it would have been otherwise. She can't imagine the nightmares. She's just very, very glad, and she wishes she could find him and hug him, but she has a feeling she burned that bridge in the ambulance bay. There's puke on her pants, too. She changes them out for Langdon's, and as she bends over to roll the cuffs, she feels something in the pocket. She slips her hand in and comes out with a little baggie of pills. She stares at them for a second, blank, then slips them back in her pocket and leaves the bathroom. The OD'd mom is stable and awake, if not quite coherent yet. Lily is out of surgery, with the marble safely removed, and Mel passes Adam and Phoebe on their way up to recovery to sit with her. Hey, Dr. King, can I get a second? Adam asks, then, when Mel stops, sends Phoebe on ahead with Perla to go find her sister, promising that he's right behind. Have you called CPS yet? Mel asks as they head into the elevator. Yeah, they're on their way. Adam doesn't look happy about it. Adam looks like he needs a stiff drink and 12 to 14 hours of sleep. But then, who doesn't? I'm going to talk to them and see what I can do to keep Phoebe and Lily together. But if their mom shows any sign of wanting to get clean, if we can get some sort of signed commitment to go to rehab to seek help, it would go a long way. I can talk to her, obviously, but... No, Mel agrees. I'd be happy to try and talk to her, as soon as she's coherent. It's one of two benzodiazepine-related conversations she has to have tonight, apparently. Thanks, Adam says, and then he's off to go sit with Phoebe to wait for Lily to wake up. Mel goes looking for Langdon and doesn't immediately find him, but she does find Santos checking the finger she reattached earlier, getting ready to discharge. Haven't seen him, she dismisses when Mel asks. Maybe he's finally accepted that this ER ain't big enough for the both of us and fucked off. Can you not right now, actually? Mel says, thanks, and leaps before she can get going. Dana directs her to a bay where one of the party bus frat boys, evidently innocent since he's not cuffed to the bed, had a bunch of glass picked out of his face earlier by Javadi. Langdon is peeling back the dressing to check the wounds. He glances over when Mel pulls aside the curtain, questioning, but she assures him, I can wait, and just hovers while he prods the edges of the wound, while he irrigates a few of the bigger ones to check for missed shards, and then replaces the gauze and bandages. The patient is mostly out of it on pain meds, but he flashes a thumbs up and a smile when Langdon tells him the wound is looking good, that he's going to be fine. You da best, doc, he says. Langdon gives him a look that's almost a laugh. Thanks, get some rest. Then he follows Mel out of the bay, closes the curtain behind them. What's up? He asks. Mel tries not to project her sheer, debilitating dread, and isn't sure she succeeds. Can I talk to you for a minute? She asks. Alone. Of course, he says, and follows her into the stairwell. There aren't really a lot of places for a private conversation in the ER, except the family room and the exam rooms. Mostly, Mel figures, because they don't want their doctors sneaking away to have private conversations in the middle of a shift, like she and Langdon are doing now. What's wrong? Langdon asks, as soon as the doors close behind them. Mel paces for a second, full of useless, angry energy, until he gets in front of her and looks at her dead in the eye, stopping her in her tracks without even touching her. Hey, would you stop? You're freaking me out. I'm not being still, Mel argues. Langdon exhales hard. There's more than one way for you to freak me out, Mel, trust me. His stupid floppy hair is in his face. She wants to tuck it back so she can see his eyes better, his pale, husky eyes, but instead she decides to rip off the band-aid. There's not really a tactful way to do it, so she just takes the pills out of her pocket and hands them to him. He takes them without looking at what they are, then freezes. I know you're not taking them, Mel says. Langdon looks up at her. The expression on his face is just shattered. I know you're not taking them, Mel says again, because you told me you're clean, and you told Robbie you're clean, and I believe you. And because it would have been kind of stupid of you to leave them at work again, and you're not stupid, which means you stole them and forgot about them, or else you wouldn't have given me these scrubs. You're not going to turn me in, he realizes, sounding floored. Mel's not 100% comfortable with the decision, and she knows that basically all she's going to see when she closes her eyes at night for the next couple weeks is Langdon on the table where Lily and Phoebe's mom was tonight, pale and blank-eyed and flatlining. But the fact she can't get around is that she trusts him. She trusts him, and she doesn't really want to do this without him. Not long term. It was bad enough when they sent her to the night shift alone. Dana and Dr. Robbie and the others are great, and Santos maybe is sort of becoming a friend. But Langdon knows, and has known since the very first day, the things she struggles with, the things so heavy she needs help carrying them, the pieces of her that are inconvenient. She knows the pieces of him that are inconvenient, too. Like this. I wasn't going to take them, Langdon says, ragged. He crumples the baggie up in one hand, rubs his other hand over his face, abruptly strung out and exhausted looking like he usually doesn't get unless they've had a much longer, much worse shift than this. I just wanted to have them because, fuck, I don't know, it made me feel better to think that I could, but I swear I haven't taken any. I know, Mel says, I believe you. Langdon nods behind his hand, his eyes are closed. Mel wants to touch him and comfort him, but she's not really sure she knows how. Instead, she clears her throat and says, with all her remaining courage, I want you to flush them, please. Not because I caught you and I'm going to tell someone, but just for me. He lowers his hand to look at her, red eyes a little wondering, and Mel can't meet his gaze. I know it's presumptuous to say do it for me instead of do it for your wife and your kids. Ex-wife, Langdon says. Mel still can't look at him, but she feels her pulse jump in her throat. Langdon turns and marches up the stairs. He makes it to the landing alone before he calls back down to her. Come on, you have to watch me, or it didn't happen. Mel rouses herself and follows him up to the third floor. The OR is quiet this time of night, only emergency surgeries, and mercifully, they haven't had many this shift. They don't pass anyone else as Mel follows Langdon into the men's bathroom, where he shoulders open a stall, dumps the pills in the toilet, and flushes. It's not relief, exactly, that Mel feels, because he still stole the pills, still squirreled them away for later, still thought about it. But something in her relaxes, and she can breathe a little easier. Thanks, she says. Hey, don't mention it. Langdon crumples the plastic baggie and pegs it in the trash. I mean, really, don't mention it, or I'd be out of a job and maybe in prison. I don't think you'd go to prison, Mel says, and even if you did, with those big blue eyes, you'd be fine. Langdon laughs like it's been startled out of him. Jesus, Mel. He slumps to sit against the counter, drained. You're really turning today into an emotional roller coaster, you know that. Sorry, Mel says. I didn't intend to. Do you think, I mean, would it be okay if I hugged you? Would it be okay? Langdon echoes, disbelieving. He opens his arms with a beckoning nod. Get in here, Dr. King. Come get some of this. Mel smiles happily and does an awkward sort of hop step over to him that she regrets as soon as she starts and slides her arms around his waist. It could be very weird. Probably, except he wraps her shoulders up and squeezes her in, exhaling while he does, like a guy sinking onto the couch at the end of a long day. Mel tucks her face into the curve of his neck, clean, a little sweaty after 8 hours on shift, smelling like the black bar of men's soap that's sitting in her shower at home right now, and consciously relaxes. Consciously lets her weight lean on him so they don't have a repeat of the incident in the ambulance bay. Which, speaking of, it's not that I didn't want you to, put your arm around me, she tells him, moving her head so her chin is tucked over his shoulder and she can talk. I wasn't expecting it, that's all. It's not something I'm used to. She feels his hand curl into a fist between her shoulder blades. His cheek presses to the top of her head, and for a second he turns like he wants to kiss her hair, but he doesn't. Mel can see her own face in the mirror over the sinks, her own hands clasped in his scrub shirt, the close-shorn hair on the back of Langdon's head. Thanks for flushing the pills, she says again. Probably, they've been hugging too long for friends. She should let go, and they should go back to work. But their pagers haven't gone off, and it feels so good to just stand there with him, folded up in the warmth of his body. Langdon makes a sound halfway between a laugh and a sigh, and she feels the motion of his chest. You know what? He says, resting his chin on top of her head. I think I'd pretty much do anything you asked. Mel feels her face turn hot and hides it in his shoulder again. Oh, she says. You know how, in movies, people are always saying, "You make me want to be a better person?" His hand comes up to hold the back of her head, gentle and firm at once, like he wants to hold her tighter, but he's restraining himself. I always thought it was bullshit. Mel can't really remember the last time someone held her like this. Becca hugs her all the time, obviously, and sometimes when she can't sleep, Mel goes and sleeps in Becca's bed and they snuggle. But this is different. She thinks it's different. Then you showed up and nothing looks the same anymore. Langdon turns his cheek again, and Mel leans her head into it without thinking. Hey, Langdon says after a second, with a hint of that shakiness he gets before an exciting procedure. Hey, Mel, do you think I could try something? He pulls back a little, so Mel does too, looking at his face. Sure, she says. Try what? His hand comes around to the side of her face, warm palm on her cheek. Mel doesn't know what Garcia is talking about. His hands are plenty big. And then he ducks his head down to kiss her, like he expects her to respond immediately in a way she doesn't. A way she doesn't really know how to. Mel puts a hand to his chest, not sure if she wants to push him away or pull him closer, and feels a shudder go through his entire body. His grip doesn't get any tighter, but his mouth opens against hers, and he drags a shaky breath like a man surfacing from underwater. After a minute, Mel tilts her head back and shifts away a bit, enough that they aren't kissing anymore. Langdon rests his forehead against hers, until she shifts away again, minutely, and he gets the picture and just goes back to hugging. "Sorry," he says, "sorry, I just haven't ever felt this way about someone I wasn't sleeping with." "It's not that I don't want it," Mel says, leaning on his shoulder again. "It's just that I'm not used to it," Langdon finishes for her, shifting position to hold her better. "No, I get it. Jesus, you're not really helping by reminding me of that, Mel. Plus, you're running around the ER in my scrubs. I should have got them fucking monogrammed." Mel smiles a bit, privately, if he can feel that it's his business. "I think you need to calm down," she says. "We kissed for 10 seconds. 20 seconds. 15 seconds max." "Fine." He presses his mouth to her hair, and she can sense him counting. And it's a struggle not to laugh until he's done, until he rests his chin on her head again and says, "There, 20 seconds. "I stand corrected," Mel says. On their way back down to the ER, they pass one of the surgical recovery rooms, and Mel sees Adam sitting with Phoebe at Lily's bedside. She pauses. Langdon keeps going for a few steps before he realizes she's stopped and comes back, hands in the pockets of his hoodie, to stand next to her. Everything looks okay. Lily's vitals are good, steady. The marble is in a glass jar on the bedside table, presumably as a prop for a future lesson about choking hazards. Child Protective Services is on the way, and if their mom, who's going to pull through this latest overdose at least, agrees to rehab and counseling, their family might not even get broken up, like Mel's was really never broken up. There's no reason for her to feel like she does. Langdon moves a little closer, so they're shoulder to shoulder, and doesn't say anything. Mel takes a measured breath in through her nose and lets it out. She wants to tell him all of it, truly all of it. She wants to unload everything she's ever felt, everything that's ever hurt her, every thought she's ever had, because he's the first person she's ever met who seems like he would be willing and interested to hear it all, to learn every part of her. But she doesn't know how to put all that into words, and anyway, they're still at work. So she just says, "My mom was, I guess you could say, flaky. She drank and dated a lot. So it was mostly just me and Becca. There was never anyone to take care of us," she doesn't say, because she's an adult. Langdon leans on her a little harder, and she leans back. "It's okay not to be okay about shit," he tells her after a minute. They're the only ones up here, the hallway dim and empty except for some nurses Mel can hear down at the next station. His voice is quiet. "Did they teach you that in rehab?" she asks. "No," Langdon says. Then when he looks over, "You taught me that." Mel doesn't say anything. A kind-looking woman from CPS shows up eventually, and they head back down to the ER. In the elevator, suddenly nervous about the prospect of facing other people, her co-workers, Santos, after she's just had an illicit encounter with Langdon in the men's bathroom. No matter how middle school said illicit encounter was, Mel stares resolvedly at the numbers ticking down and says, "If you wanted, you could probably, I mean, if you're just looking for someone, I know some of the nurses are interested. They'd probably be more cooperative." Langdon gives her a very strange look, half bemusement, half the expression he had when she told him she knew he wasn't taking the pills. Like she stunned him in a way that's mortally painful. It sounds like it hurts him to joke, "Are you calling the nurses easy?" "No," Mel says quickly. "No, just..." She doesn't know how to finish that sentence. "Less difficult," which is basically a synonym for easy. "More experienced, maybe." Langdon seems like he knows what she was going to say anyway. "Princess and Perla don't make me want to be a better man." "I don't think Princess and Perla are interested, actually. Kim, on the other hand." "Mel," Langdon says, oddly intense. "You make me feel like I'm on fire. I've never felt... Not even with Abby, okay? It's barely coherent. But he sounds like if he has to say another word, he might die." "Okay," Mel says. He meets her eyes. "Yeah?" Mel nods. "You'll have to be patient with me. I've been waiting my whole life for you. I think I can wait a while longer." And then the elevator arrives. The doors slide open and their pagers go off at the same moment that Dr. Robbie shouts from across the room, which is in abject chaos. At least twice as crowded as it was when they left. A baby wailing and Santos and Jesse wrestling a guy who keeps trying to lunge off the bed. Princess and Perla running over with soft restraints. "Dr. Langdon, trauma 2. Dr. King, you're with me in trauma 1. And Mel glances at Langdon one last time and finds him already looking back. And then they break apart, moving at the same moment, and plunge into the fray. Reader's notes. I watched The Pit and got so deeply obsessed. Nothing has done this to my brain in years. It's wild. And I love to be in those first few months of a new fandom and watch things come together and people start writing and tropes start forming and stuff. It's so fun. And SPQR has been one of my favorite writers for like years and years and years. Followed them through many a fandom. And as soon as I read this fic, I was like, oh, absolutely. I want to podfic it. Gotta do it now. Immediately. While the brain juices are running high. And then, like 2 days after that, that article came out. So this is going to be archive locked. I'm not going to do a manifesto about fic communities and fic staying in fic communities and how fucking weird it is to post a rec list to a website that's like a journal, like, no. But I care so deeply about these little weirdos. Okay, that's all I have to say.